This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Good evening and welcome to What Makes It Great. I'm David Ozenberg. This, our third season of broadcasting this very popular series, as hosted by composer, conductor, author, and commentator Rob Capello. For over 20 years, Rob has brought the joy and wonder of classical music and unraveling some of its mysteries to audiences of all ages and backgrounds. One of the greatest communicators since Leonard Bernstein, Rob's programs are characterized by his unique ability to create that aha moment for his audiences and collaborators, whatever their level of musical sophistication or naivete. Rob's work brings music into people's lives, opening new ears to musical experiences and helping people to listen actively rather than just hear. Rob's range of activities is astonishingly broad, including his What Makes It Great presentations, now going on for over 20 years in New York and Boston, his family compositions and family music events, his city pieces, corporate programs, and residencies with institutions as diverse as the National Gallery of Canada and Stanford University. The reach of his interactive events and activities is wide, from Native American tribal communities in Montana and inner-city high school students in Louisiana to audiences in Kyoto and Kuala Lumpur, and from little ones barely out of diapers to musicologists in Ivy League programs. His career has been marked by numerous major awards and grants. He won first prize in the Fontainebleau Casa des Sceaux piano competition and was second prize winner of the Antal Doraty Conductors competition with the Detroit Symphony. He's also been a recipient of an Exxon Meet the Composer grant and numerous ASCAP awards. He's conducted many of North America's orchestras, as well as new works of musical theater, ranging from the Tony Award-winning Nine on Broadway to the premiere of Frida for the opening of the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival. At 19, Rob interrupted his academic work at Yale University to study with the legendary Nadia Boulanger. 2 years later, after graduating Phi Beta Kappa from Yale, he continued his studies at Eastman School of Music. After graduating from Eastman, he returned to Yale, where he was assistant professor for 6 years at the university. He dedicates his summer months to writing and composing new music. He was the first composer to be granted the rights to set Dr. Seuss's words to music, and his Green Eggs and Ham has been called the most successful piece written for families this half century. There's a CD featuring Nathan Gunn and Isabel Leonard in two of his most popular family music compositions, Chris von Alsberg's Polar Express and Dr. Seuss's Gertrude McFuzz. He's appeared on the NBC Today Show. He's presented a special What Makes It Great for broadcast on PBS's Live from Lincoln Center. And he's written two books, the award-winning All You Have to Do Is Listen and What Makes It Great, the first book of its kind to be especially designed for the iPad with embedded musical examples. And he's currently finishing a new book on the American Songbook. Tonight's What Makes It Great will focus on the American Songbook and feature two guest artists, Sally Wilfert, who has appeared on Broadway in the Tony Award-winning production of Assassins and The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and King David. She has toured the country in the first national tour of the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. She's appeared with Rob before in What Makes It Great programs in major venues across the country. Also, we'll hear from Michael Winter, who is acclaimed by the New York Times as a theater singer of unusual refinement with a voice that traverses genres. He's also been a veteran of programs with Rob Capello. His Broadway credits include 33 Variations, Fun Home, Mamma Mia, The Crucible, 1776, Artist Descending a Staircase, and Damn Yankees. He is presently traveling with the national tour of Fun Home. His concert credits include performances at New York's Town Hall, Symphony Space, appearing with the New York Pops at Carnegie Hall, and the New York Philharmonic at Avery Fisher Hall. This will be a songbook program by Rob tonight, focusing on the songs of George Gershwin, and these What Makes It Great programs take a little bit different format from normal, where usually the work in question is dissected in demonstration through discussion and musical examples with an intermission and then a complete performance on the other side. His songbook sessions, as Rob will tell his audience, run without break. And now I take you to the home of What Makes It Great, this program recorded just a couple weeks ago on the stage of Merkin Concert Hall at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan, and your host, Rob Capello.
Good evening and welcome to the first of our four What Makes It Great programs this season. Looking ahead just for a moment, our second program in December focuses on Beethoven's astonishing final string quartet, written at the very end of his life, with one of the most incredible backstories of any piece of music ever written. Then, in January and March, we'll actually have a full symphony orchestra on stage for two of the most famous symphonies in the repertoire. Haydn's final symphonic masterpiece, his so-called London Symphony No. 104 in January, and then Dvorak's sunniest symphony, his ever-popular 8th symphony in G major, to finish the season on an appropriately upbeat note in March. Attendance is required at all four programs. Now, how many of you have been to a What Makes a Great program before in the past? Oh, wow, excellent, great. Any of you coming for the first time? Oh, even better, great. Before we begin, just a quick word on the format for tonight's program, which, unlike all the other programs this season, will be performed without intermission. I wasn't sure that was a good reaction or a bad reaction. Like, yes, we'll get home earlier. Oh, no, okay. Because the songs we're going to look at are all relatively short, and I want you to hear each one right after our discussion. We're first going to discuss each song in exhilarating or excruciating detail, depending on your point of view, and then immediately perform it. Then do the same for the next. Discuss, perform. Finally, when we finish the last song and the tumultuous applause, flower throwing, and bravos have finally died down, we will go straight into a short question and answer session with myself and our two singers, where you can ask anything you like about the program, Gershwin, music, our singers' thoughts on the future of Broadway, tips on how to get Hamilton tickets, anything you like, and we'll do our best to answer. It's just possible that there might be one final exquisite, poignant, heartbreaking encore at the end of the Q&A, which you won't want to miss, which will definitely send you home singing and possibly misty-eyed. So I hope you'll stay with us to the bitter end. The entire thing should take about 90 intermissionless minutes. So let's get started by looking at one of the most famous songs in the entire American songbook repertoire, I Got Rhythm. Would you please welcome the incomparable Sally Wilford? I Got Rhythm from Girl Crazy was the song that made Ethel Merman famous at the age of 22. The story of how she got involved with the show is itself a Broadway plot. During the summer of 1930, Merman was singing at the Brooklyn Paramount Movie Theater when Vinton Friedley, Girl Crazy's producer, heard her and raced backstage to introduce himself. In between performances, covered in stage makeup, he dragged her to Gershwin's apartment to hear the score to Girl Crazy while Gershwin sight-read some of the tunes she was singing at the time, and she was hired on the spot. Her debut in Philadelphia and then in New York quickly became the stuff of theater legend. In her autobiography, Merman writes, quote, "As I went into the second chorus of I Got Rhythm, I held a note for 16 bars while the orchestra played the melodic line, a big tootie thing, against the note I was holding. By the time I'd held that note for 4 bars, the audience was applauding." Hint, hint. "They applauded through the whole chorus, and I did several encores. It seemed to do something to them, not because it was sweet or beautiful, but because it was exciting. So, what is it that made this song so exciting? What is it that has made this the most famous song in the entire American songbook repertoire? Well, surely it is not the inane, forgettable plot about a slick New York playboy, Danny Churchill, who gets sent off for a kind of tough love cure to Custerville, Arizona, a town without any women, which he proceeds to turn into a slick dude ranch with a saloon where, lo and behold, Ethel Merman happens to be the singer. So if it's not the ridiculous plot, is it the lyrics? Well, here's Ira Gershwin describing the process of writing. Quote, "Filling in the 73 syllables of the refrain wasn't as simple as it sounds. For over 2 weeks, I kept fooling around with various titles and with sets of double rhymes for the trios of short 2-foot lines. I'll ad-lib a dummy to show you where I was at. Roly-poly, eating solely, ravioli, better watch your diet or bust. Lunch or dinner, you're a sinner, please get thinner, losing all that fat is a must. Yet no matter what series of double rhymes, even pretty good ones I tried, the results were not quite satisfactory. They seemed at best to give a pleasant and jingly Mother Goose quality to a tune which should throw its weight around more. Getting nowhere, I then found myself not bothering with a rhyme scheme I considered necessary, AAAB, CCCB, and experimenting with non-rhyming lines like just go forward, don't look backward, and you'll soon be winding up ahead of the game. This approach felt stronger, and I finally arrived at the present refrain with only one more door and mind him, find him as rhymes. Though there is nothing remarkable about this, it was a bit daring for me, who usually depended on rhyme insurance. Now, though I'll have much more to say about the extraordinary pairing of Ira and George Gershwin as the program progresses, it should already be clear from this quote, if George as a composer was utterly fluent, facile, and instinctual, Ira was the exact opposite. Self-aware, self-critical, and painstakingly slow. In the time it would take Ira to craft a single line of a song, George could have written half a show. But this should never blind us to the craft behind George's instinct, and I Got Rhythm is a masterpiece of craft. You know, one of the absolutely essential ingredients for any great popular music songwriter is the ability to create character and mood in an instant. A classic Broadway song has to tell a complete story in only 32 measures, so clarity and economy are absolute essentials, and the greatness of I Got Rhythm all grows out of its opening two measures. Now, though normally a song that repeats the lyric "Who could ask for anything more" four times would be called "Who could ask for anything more," whether consciously or unconsciously, the decision to call the song "I Got Rhythm" rather than "Who could ask for anything more" is the first choice of genius, since the song is defined by the fact that its main idea has rhythm, and that highly distinctive rhythm dominates the entire song. Here are the famous opening eight measures of "I Got Rhythm."
I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man, who could ask for anything more?
Now, this one phrase goes to the heart of what makes Gershwin great. Let's build up this key opening rhythm's greatness together in three steps, starting with a version that I wrote of "I got rhythm, I got music" that has absolutely no rhythm and no music whatsoever. Gershwin's notes, but my rhythm, we'll sing, then you copy.
I got rhythm, I got music.
She does very well on those bad examples. Sing it just as badly as her. Ready? Sing.
I got rhythm, I got music.
Excellent. Now let's give it just a little bit of rhythm, a little bit of music by syncopating it, singing it off the beat. This is almost Gershwin. Again, we'll sing, then you copy. And
I got rhythm.
Try that. Ready and sing.
I got rhythm, I got music.
All right, now follow closely. What makes it Gershwin? In the versions you just sang, if you could clap really quickly, you would notice that I, got, and ri all had four fast claps to the notes you sang. I'll demonstrate, then you copy. So you've been going, I got rhythm, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, clap. So say, I got rhythm, four claps for each one. Ready, go. I got rhythm. No one at the end. One more time. Ready, go. I got rhythm. Excellently. But Gershwin's version starts on an offbeat, and each note of I got rhythm lasts three, not four beats, and that's what makes it new, unusual, great, and what makes it have rhythm. So it's not four, but it's, and it starts with a rest, it's rest, I got rhythm, or rest, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, stop. Let's try it. Ready, and go. I got rhythm. Excellent finish. And that rhythm is the key to the entire song, because it's the exact same rhythm as I Got Music, like this.
I got music.
Which is the exact same rhythm as I Got My Man.
I got my man.
And if Gershwin were a terrible composer, he could have finished the phrase with yet another phrase just in that rhythm as well, like this.
Who needs more?
I wrote that version. but instead we get the musical equivalent of a punchline, not who needs more, but the only new rhythm in the entire phrase, like this.
Who could ask for anything more?
But it's not only the rhythm that makes these opening eight measures great. The notes complement the rhythm story in an amazing way. Now, the song opens with four ascending notes. I'm just calling them 1, 2, 3, 4. Can you hear that the next four notes are those first four backwards? 4, 3, 2, 1. Just nod your head so I know you're with me, right? Doesn't have to be true, just nod. Okay. Remember, there's no intermission. Okay. So we start going forward, 1, 2, 3, 4. Then we go backwards, 4, 3, 2, 1. We go forwards again, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then after using nothing but the same four notes, forwards and backwards, for the first three lines, the notes, like the rhythm, are brand new to make a punchline for who could ask for anything more. Now, because this one phrase contains the essence of Gershwin, I want to look with you at every element. Now, we've just looked at the rhythm, and we've looked at the melody. Now let's look at the bass line and the harmony. By bass line, I mean the lowest voice of the piano that would normally be plucked by a double bass in the pit of the orchestra. Like everything else, the bass line is clear, simple, yet surprising. He could easily have written a perfectly symmetrical bass line with a two-measure pattern played twice like this. 1, 2, repeat. 1, 2. Now, if there are four measures in this pattern, 1, 2, 3, 4, which does he change? 1, 2, 3, or 4? I'll try not to give it away. Which one changes? 3. It's good to feel smart at the beginning of the evening. All right. Last but not least, the harmony is fantastic. Gershwin's ear for harmony went far beyond most of the composers at the time. Listen closely. Under I Got Rhythm, each right-hand chord has three notes. I'll roll them so you can hear. You have to listen closely for this one. 1, 2, 3. Got it, three notes in each right-hand chord. He could easily have continued with three note chords in the next measure like this. But listen to the richness he gets by adding a fourth note. Not this, but he writes. And then, this is really subtle, not an immediate resolution like this, resolve, but he delays the resolution. Lay and only resolves there. Then he could easily have stayed with bright major chords for I Got My Man Who, like this. I got my man who. That would be a normal chord for who. But instead of my man who, we get a bluesy minor chord like this. That one minor chord is a moment of doubt for her. Maybe I'm not enough. You know, in the show, her husband's actually fooling around with other women, and she really is trying to convince herself that she has it all. That one minor chord is her moment of doubt, which makes the ending, back in a bright major key, incredibly upbeat and resolved. All doubt gone, no worries, who could ask for anything more? Now, the reason I've spent so much time on these opening eight measures, and you're wondering how we will ever get out of here in 90 minutes, it's not only because they're the essence of the rest of the song, but they're the essence of Gershwin's entire approach to songwriting. In a popular song, as those of you who know who have been to one of these songbook evenings before, how many have been to one of my songbook evenings before? Right. As those of you know who have been to one of these before, the opening eight measure idea, like the one you just heard, is not only the key to the rest of a song, it actually makes up 75% of the song. If we call that opening eight measure idea A, then the standard form of 95% of the Broadway songs you've heard in your entire life is what we call AABA. You start off with an eight measure idea. I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man who could ask for anything more. Eight measures A. Then you repeat the music of A with new words. I got daisies in green pastures. I got my man who could ask for anything more. Eight more A. Then you go to the only new idea, which we'll call B. Old man trouble, I don't mind him. You won't find him round my door. Eight bars. And then back one more time to A, eight again. So you've got 8 plus 8 plus 8 plus 8, 32 bars, of which 24 bars are the same music. So that opening eight-measure idea better contain the essence of the song and the character. And not only that, in this particular song, that opening eight-measure idea is also at the heart of the B section as well in a fascinating way. So what's going to happen is I'm going to play you the first four bars of the opening, and then I want you to clap the rhythm I played as soon as I finished. It starts with a rest, and then you clap the rhythm as soon as I finish. So it was, rest, I got rhythm, pause, pause. I got music, you clap. Pause, pause. One more time, and go. Ah. Pause, pause. That's the rhythm of the opening eight-measure idea. Now I'm going to play the first four measures of the B section. You clap the rhythm after I play it. Again, it starts with a rest. And rest, old man trouble. Pause, pause. I don't mind him. You clap. Pause, pause. So we've got the exact same rhythm with different notes. Now, the rhythm for you won't find him is exactly the same. You won't find him. And then we conclude with a one-note shorter version in the same rhythm, round my door. Now, though the rhythm of the B section comes from the A section, the melody and their harmony have their own independent logic, and it's classic Gershwin. Once again, the idea couldn't be simpler. Four notes, the first three are the same. The same note up for old man trouble. Get that in your ear. The same note up, which gets balanced, of course, by the same note down. Classic Gershwin. We start to repeat the idea lower to create a pattern. The same note up, but instead of finishing symmetrically with the same note down, we finish by cutting off the last note. No leaps at all, just punchline, the same note. But what really makes this B section special is actually the harmony, and you have to listen really closely to this. Since the melody repeats the same note three times, the same note up, he could have easily repeated the same chord three times. The same note could have been the same chord up. Get that in your ear, this would be ordinary. The same note up. But in Gershwin's version, each repeated melody note gets a different chord with two notes always rising higher. Not this, but Gershwin. I mean, that is great. Now then, not three repeated chords like this, the same chord down, but he slithers down like this. Slither down. Then up, slither up, and he could have finished symmetrically like this, but instead we get a surprising bass note and then a punchline. All right, you're experts. We just did A, we did A, we did B. What comes next? And how many measures? Eight. You are so smart. Okay. One of the glories of having a form as regular as the Broadway song form, kind of like a sonnet or a haiku, is because the form is so standardized, the slightest variation makes an enormous impression, and the one play with form actually makes the ending. Now, if Gershwin had simply copied A a third time, it would have lasted eight measures, and the song would have ended like this.
I got starlight, I got sweet dreams, I got my man who could ask for anything more.
Not bad day at the office. But instead of simply finishing with two measures after I got my man,
I got my man,
he adds two extra measures, saying the line twice for emphasis. First, asking it as if it were a question like this.
Who could ask for anything more?
And then answering her own question, now it's a statement, all doubt gone.
Who could ask for anything more?
8 plus 8 plus 8 plus 10, with the two extra measures necessary to convince her and us that she really has got it all. Who could ask for anything more? And now we're going to do the whole song with the introduction or the verse that almost no one knows. I'll be curious to know after we do it how many of you have actually heard this verse or introduction before, with Ethel's high C, and for the same price, an interlude transcribed note for note from Gershwin's virtuoso variation on I Got Rhythm as well. So I Got Rhythm from Girl Crazy, 1930, lyrics by Ira, music by George.
Days can be sunny with never a sigh. Don't need what money can buy. Birds in the trees sing their day full of song. Why shouldn't we sing along? I'm chipper all the day, happy with my lot. How do I get that way? Look at what I've got. I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man, who could ask for anything more? I've got daisies in green pastures, I got my man, who could ask for anything more? Old man Trouble, I don't mind him, you won't find him round my door. I got starlight, I got sweet dreams, I got my man, who could ask for anything more? Who could ask for anything more?
Not a bad opening number. All right. They Can't Take That Away From Me was written for the inimitable Fred Astaire, and I'd like to welcome our Fred Astaire for the evening, the equally urbane Mr. Michael Winther. They Can't Take That Away From Me was one of Gershwin's last songs, written in 1937, the year of his death, for the movie Shall We Dance. How many people have seen that movie? Oh, yeah. Like everything else, it's available on YouTube. Astaire seemed to bring out the best in both Gershwin's, in particular his surface reticence, concealing a kind of deeply felt emotion, mirrored Ira's personality in ways that seemed to draw out some of his most heartfelt lyrics. Astaire sings this song to Ginger Rogers on a ferry when it seems like it might not work out after all and they might not get together. At heart, the song is really about appreciating the value of things even if they don't work out. As Ira's beautiful lyric puts it, though the song might end, metaphorically, the relationship might fail, the melody or the memory lingers on. The song is a masterpiece of subtlety and indirection, and details are absolutely everything. If I change one rhythmic detail in the opening of this song, the music is infinitely less poignant. Here's my version of the introduction with one rhythmic change.
Our romance won't end on a sorrowful note.
So listen to my rhythm on sorrowful note and then copy it like this.
Sorrowful note.
It's almost chipper or happy, anything but sorrowful. Do it like he did it, and
sorrowful note.
But now listen to Gershwin's drawn-out, more sorrowful rhythm, a triplet like this.
Sorrowful note.
Try that, and I think a little wiggle of the hips helps the sorrow a little bit. Sing that.
Sorrowful note.
Amazing how much difference a rhythm can make. Then the music subtly changes key for an instant to represent Ginger Rogers' character Linda being gone, like this.
Though by tomorrow you're gone.
Now the music starts to repeat the opening, for the song is ended, like this.
The song is ended.
If he had copied the first phrase exactly, it would have continued like this.
But as the songwriter wrote.
Finishing low. But instead it finishes higher on rote, like this.
But as the songwriter wrote.
As ever so slightly, his emotion is lifted by her melody, which lingers on like this.
The melody lingers on.
Which actually takes us to a new key. We had been here. Suddenly now we find ourselves here. Her memory literally has brought back a key associated with her. The past has its own key in the song, and then it lingers on. Now listen, this is very subtle. It continues in the key of the past, for they may take you from me, like this.
They may take you from me.
The phrase starts to repeat musically for I'll miss your fond caress. An exact copy, still in a major key, would sound like this. Listen particularly to the ending on the word caress.
I'll miss your fond caress.
That would be normal. But listen to the shock on the last note of caress to show us what the missing actually feels like on an utterly surprising minor chord. You know, great songwriters don't really set words to music. What they set is the emotion behind the words. So instead of this major chord at the end, listen to the minor chord on caress like this.
I'll miss your fond caress.
And then listen to the real sadness in the dissonant chords underneath, but though they take you from me.
But though they take you from me.
And then we drift wistfully back to the past to escape the pain of loss like this.
I'll still pose as.
Isn't that the saddest thing you've ever heard? Now, having found the right key, the lilting rhythm that defined their time together breezes into the song as memory takes over in the piano before it even hits the voice. What they actually had together was this easy swing. The piano's rhythm literally is their time together.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me.
I mean, these eight bars are just superb in every way. First, watch how much emotion there is in a single rhythm. If I make one rhythm squarer in the way you wear your hat, their entire relationship vanishes. One rhythm I change. And a one.
The way you wear your hat.
Try that version and sing.
The way you wear your hat.
I mean, it's done, it's over. But now toss off hat early as a syncopation and it becomes offhanded. It becomes intimate, casually poignant, as if somehow the memory, the vision of that hat caught you by surprise. All I'm changing is the rhythm and sing.
The way you wear your hat.
Try that and sing.
The way you wear your hat.
And look at your neighbor just casually as you do it. One more time and one.
The way you wear your hat.
I mean, isn't that fantastic rhythm? Now, let's look closely at this melody. This is classic Gershwin. All right, two questions for you. First, how many notes are there in total in the opening idea? I'm about to play it. How many notes? How many notes? Oh, there's a bunch of clever people talking about pitches saying two. And yes, that's true. How many times does my finger hit the key? You got to be very specific in New York. All right. How many times has my finger hit the key? 6 times. How many of those notes are the same? One more time. How many people didn't get it and feel badly about themselves? One more time. Here we go. So 5 of them are same. So we're going to call this 1, 2, 3, 4, leap up. Okay, now in the next one, how many notes are there in the next idea, and do we leap up or down at the end? Listen. How many notes are the same? 5. We got multiple, and here we go. 5 are the same, and we leap up or down? Down. So we balance 1, 2, 3, 4, leap up, with 1, 2, 3, 4, leap down. 5 repeated, and now we leap down. Now, each one represents a different emotion just by that leap. The leap up is the way she wore her hat. You see it right here? That's how she wore her hat, leap up. Then the leap down is how she sipped her tea, like this, in her lap, okay? Now, he almost repeats fragment 1 for the memory of all that. It would have been the memory of all that. But thinking back to the memory, not just of each detail, but of all that, raises the emotional temperature and raises the pitch as well. So instead of all that, it now goes the memory of all that. And now, the wistfulness is replaced by real emotion, but just for the end of the phrase. And because of its brevity, when it breaks through, it's doubly powerful. Now, the text here, "No, no, they can't take that away from me," is completely honest and heartfelt. It's almost despairing in context. Notice there are 2 no's. Not just, "No, they can't take that away from me," but, "No, no, they can't take that away from me." Now, watch this. The melody is actually the highest note of the phrase so far. Follow the highest notes. We started here. That was the highest note so far. No problem there. Then we raised it to here. But no is even higher. Okay. Then, though that same note repeats 3 times, no, no, they, rather than simply using the same 3 chords underneath the note, which would have been fine, no, no, they, he uses 3 different chords, each one more poignant than the one before, to show the emotion. No, no, they. And then the highest note of the entire phrase comes as the climax of no, no, they can't. That's the highest note of the entire phrase. They can't, but then immediately back under control. I mean, this is Fred Astaire, not Dame Edna. So they can't take that away, back under control. So Astaire has actually traveled from wistful, nostalgic reminiscence to real emotional honesty in how many measures in an opening 8 section? 8 measures. Just in case you don't believe me, 1, the way you wear your hat. 3, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. Okay, if those first 8 bars are A, what comes next? A, with new lyrics, which also gives us a chance to linger over some of the beautiful details in the song. One of the lovely things about this melody is the pause at the end of each thought. The way you wear your hat, pause. The way you sip your tea, pause. The pause gives the singer and the audience time to really let each image register. The way you wear your hat, you get to think about it. The way you sip your tea. It also gives the orchestra time to fill in the singer's thought during the vocal pause and echo the singer's rhythm, as if somehow the orchestra is the singer's subconscious, turning over each image in the mind as well. Now, the second verse opens with this lovely lyric, "The way your smile just beams," and a 1.
The way your smile just beams.
And the orchestra gets to think about that smile and echo the singer's rhythm. And then listen to the beautiful chord on sing and this lovely lyric, remembering the way she sang off key like this.
The way you sing off key.
I mean, who does not want to be remembered like that? Lovingly for how you sing off key. I mean, again, the phrase escalates from the level of detail to the more universal, the way you haunt my dreams like this, and a one.
The way you haunt my dreams.
Listen to these haunting chords.
No, no, they can't take that away from me.
Okay, so we've had eight bars A. What comes next?
B.
Okay. In a fascinating interview about the B section, Ira Gershwin talks about how he wrote it, and it really gives you a feel for who he is and how he worked. Now, the original lyrics, or the lyrics as printed to the B section are, quote, "We may never, never meet again on the bumpy road to love. Still, I'll always, always keep the memory of." Now, many years later, Ira, who was a perpetual tinkerer, thought that he could improve this by changing the third line from "still I'll always, always keep the memory of" to "still I don't know when I won't be thinking of," and then back to "the way you hold your knife." Quote from him, which would rhyme, he says, "again and when" on important notes where no rhyme now exists. Also, the sequence, "I don't know when I won't," contains a double negative, a form of phrasing I sometimes find myself favoring over a simple affirmative. Half an hour later, though, he had second thoughts. "If the above had occurred to me originally, I'd have kept it. But now, after some reflection, no dice." Despite the rhyme and the indirect affirmative, "always, always," following "never, never," plus all the "no, no's," makes a better balanced refrain, so stet, keep it as printed. Now, musically, notice how the dissonant chords underneath the melody show the feelings behind the words that the debonair Astaire and Ira Gershwin would never declare overtly. George's music has to do it for them.
"We may never, never meet again on the
bumpy road. Listen to these chords.
To love."
And once again, mood shifts show up in subtle variations. An exact repeat of this music for "still I'll always keep the memory" would sound like this.
"Still I'll always, always keep the mem."
But listen to the poignant sadness and resignation as the vocal line just can't reach that high and instead turns back towards memory. So instead of "keep the mem," one note lower makes all the difference, like this.
"Keep the memory."
All right, we've finished eight bars A. What comes next?
A,
exactly. Return to A. And the rhythm of the piano brings us back from that overt emotionalism of the B section back to the world of memory. And once again, a tiny change in this miniature universe makes a stunning impact. If he had copied A exactly, the return would have gone like this.
"The way you hold your knife, the way we dance till three."
Here's what it should have been.
"The way you changed my life."
But this is the key line of the entire song. As in nearly all great Gershwin songs, there's some moment where the facade vanishes, where the gleaming, elegant world of tuxedos, the Gershwin's fancy Riverside Drive penthouses and art collections, is put aside and truth is spoken. "The way you've changed my life." That's what this song is really about. It's not about hats. It's not about sipping tea. It's about the way you've changed my life. So it can't be like the first time. Once again, here was the first time, and one.
"The way you've changed my life."
It has to be higher, and one note makes all the difference. It's like this, and a one.
"The way you've changed my life."
Which pushes the no-nos higher as well. Originally, the no-nos were down here.
"No, no, they..."
Now the no-nos are all the way up here.
"No, no, they can't take that away from me."
And just like in I Got Rhythm, emotion breaks the form. 8 plus 8 plus 8 plus 8 becomes 8 plus 8 plus 8 plus 10, and the two extra measures are necessary for the one word that sums up the essence of the entire song. After no, no, always paired no's, now there's one single no on a single heart-rending chord like this.
No.
That's it. That's as much overt despair as you're going to get from Astaire and Gershwin. But it's powerful precisely because of the restraint of that one no. And then an almost wistful, rocking version of the title line to close. As the syncopated, "They can't take that away from me," gets soothingly stretched out to wistful long notes to become this.
They can't take that away from me.
And now one of Gershwin's last songs, published in February of 1937, only 5 months before his death, from the movie Shall We Dance? They can't take that away from me.
Won't end on a sorrowful note. Though by tomorrow you're gone, the song has ended, but as the songwriter wrote, the melody lingers on. They may take you from me, I'll miss your fond caress. But though they take you from me, I'll still possess the way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me, the way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never meet again on that bumpy road to love. Still, I'll always, always keep the memory of the way you hold your knife, the way we dance till three, the way you changed my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away from me. The way you changed my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away. No, they can't take that away. No, they can't take that away from me.